Session 3, The Role of a Family Philosophy. The happiest families cultivate members who feel like part of a cohesive unit. Successful families, like successful businesses, are value-driven. They create clear-cut goals and roles for each family member. In this session, Betty and Brian will help you evaluate your family's philosophy.
One of the most powerful things that you can do to build a strong, cohesive family is to articulate a very clear family philosophy, to clearly agree with your spouse and then with your children on what values your family stands for. And so in this session, why don't we talk about values and how important they are to an effective life, and especially how important they are to raising outstanding young people.
That's because a framework of values helps us sort out what we're going to do. In other words, parenting is a very deliberate kind of thing. It doesn't just happen day by day, but instead has a framework that allows us to make certain decisions over others and therefore prioritize what's really important.
One of the greatest breakthroughs in psychology in the 20th century has been the discovery of the self-concept. The self-concept is the set of organizing beliefs, principles, ideas, and values that creates a person's personality. And what we have found is that any unit made up of human beings also has a self-concept. An individual has a self-concept or set of beliefs about themselves, but a family, a corporation, even a country has its own self-concept. And there's three parts to the self-concept that affect this. And the first part is the self-ideal, is the values that a person has. And in all of our adult seminars, we find that the most successful, the most effective, the most productive people are those who have very, very clear values and ideals that they have thought through and articulated. The least successful and least happy people are those who have very fuzzy values and ideals, and in many cases, none at all.
You know, when we work in organizations, we know that helping them devise strategies, what leader skills are needed, what role responsibilities each individual in that company is going to have to carry out, how happy they will be, how successful they will be, all springs back to the values that that company has. And so we ask companies to identify their values. What do they stand for? And likewise, successful families, happy families, have a framework of values that all of their actions come from.
The starting point of setting a family philosophy, a mission statement, and a set of values is to ask, how would our family, how would our children be described if our family was an outstanding family, say it was going to be written up in a national magazine, or if our children were outstanding young people and were to go on to acclaim in their adult lives? What values would most characterize them? When we work with corporations, we find that almost invariably the corporation places as the very highest value integrity. And they feel that the value of integrity is the value that guarantees all the other values. In a family, of course, you have different values. You have values that primarily deal with how the members of the family are going to relate and interact with each other.
And an important part of that comes from the measures of self-esteem. We've been talking in earlier sessions about the importance of physical safety and emotional security and the belongingness needs and the feelings of competence and achievement and so on. And these are very important characteristics that values are centered on.
Yes, and a value has to be a guiding principle that acts as a determinant of behavior. Once you have set a value very clearly, then you organize all of your behaviors and your interactions in the family around the value. For example, we have a value in our house that we will be helpful to each other. And so therefore, one of the behaviors that is expected is that the children help each other. When children are being helpful, they're rewarded and encouraged, and they are praised and reinforced. And when children are avoiding doing their share or helping others, this is something that we talk about because we say we always are helpful to each other. Or another value is that we share. Or another value is that we always tell the truth. Or another value is that we always fulfill our responsibilities and keep our rooms clean or our parts of the house clean.
Right. In other words, we make decisions around what really is important to us.
Yes. Sometimes, for instance, my children will drop a glass, and this has happened a couple of times, and the glass will break and the child will become upset. And I'll come over and I'll say, just a minute, what happened? And the child said, I dropped the glass, and they'll be crying. And I'll say, well, was it an accident? And the child will say, yes, it was an accident. I'll say, well, children are more important than glasses. Children are the most important thing in the world to us. So don't worry about the glass. Let's get together and clean it up. but you're far more important than the class. So the child understands that he or she is more important than something physical, and that's a very important value.
Right, the value that a child is purposeful is coming through. Brian, when I work with parents across the nation, one of the things that I impress upon them is that our values show very clearly. We needn't just talk about our values. You know, we walk our talk, and we need to talk our walk, so to speak. I always use the example of a woman who you know, is in a hurry, and you see this same scenario played out many times. You can see someone in a hurry, and they're rushing to accomplish something, and their child, their toddler behind them, you know, will fall to the ground or just sit down and start crying, and he's tired and worn out. And the parent will look and, in a disgusted tone, come back and swat the child and say, "Now you have something to cry about." Well, there's a philosophy going on there. Yes. And unfortunately, that philosophy is going to live out unless the parent decides to break with that throughout his lifetime, and you almost feel sorry for the child. That same scenario can be going on across town. You can see a parent who is also in a hurry, who, you know, child in the same situation, tired, little legs, you know, with no urgency for the parents getting this task done. And a parent will come back, pick up the child, and justifying her action, say, "Oh, I've got to hurry. We've got to get to the post office before it closes," or something. She will live out a different philosophy for her child. And I think it's important that we as parents always be thinking through our philosophy, because sometimes we slip back into the old. Sometimes we live out our parents' values, and maybe we want to break with that. Maybe we want to rethink a new set of ideals we want for our family.
Yes. And if we say, one of my values is that I want to be an excellent parent, and the way I define that value is that I will do everything possible to raise my children happy and healthy and with high self-esteem, then we use that as our organizing principle for our behaviors. I tell you a little story. When Christina was about 3 or 4 years old, my wife and I were taking one of our family walks, and we were walking around the neighborhood, about a mile walk. And Christina was dawdling. She had picked up a stick, and she was poking the stick in lawns and flower beds and hedges, and she was dawdling. Well, I was out for a walk. I wanted the exercise. So I'd say, "Come on, Christina, hurry up." And she'd speed up a little bit, and then she'd slow down, and she'd fool around with the stick, and she'd poke. And I'd go back, and I'd say, "Now hurry up. Now quit fooling around," because I was getting a little frustrated. I wasn't getting any exercise, which was why I was on this walk. And she would keep poking around. Finally, I said, "All right, that's it." And I went back, and I took the stick out of her hand, and I threw it away as far as I could. And I grabbed her by the hand, and I walked down the sidewalk to where Barbara was waiting about 100 yards ahead. And I said, "I've told you that if you fool around, I was going to get rid of that stick. Now you just come with me. We're on a walk, and you're going to darn well walk." And she started crying and hollering and looking back over her shoulder at the stick longingly, as though a lost lover was leaving on a train. And she was looking at the stick, and she was crying, and I was lecturing to her. And suddenly I had this flash, and I never will forget this. I realized that when I was a child, whenever I did something that displeased my father, he took something of mine that was really important, and he took it away and threw it away forever. And it could be something very small that I'd done it as a mistake, but he would always punish me by taking away something that was important to me and never give it back. It wasn't as if he took it away and then gave it back. He never gave it back. And I remember things that were terribly important in my childhood that I lost forever because of one little thing that I did. And I saw that after all the swearing for years that I would never duplicate my parents' behavior, here I was doing the same thing to my child, taking the stick away that was important to my child to punish her for not living up to my expectations. So I caught myself and I stopped. I said, just a minute here, Christina, you wait right here. And I ran back half a block across the street on the grass, and I got that stick, and I brought it all the way back, and I gave her the stick, and I said, "Here you go, honey. Here's your stick back. You take as much time as you want." And I had that moment of clarity that my value was that the purpose of this walk was part of my being a good parent. It was for her, too. And part of her need was to grow and to explore and to touch and taste and feel her environment. And I never made that mistake on my subsequent children. Each time I had that tendency, I realized, wait a minute, what's important here? And that's the key question. What's important here?
I'm reminded of how keeping my values in front of me as I make decisions along my life, how those values have really changed my life. They've redirected it many times. One of my highest values, actually I'd have to say the highest value, is my daughter. I mean, raising her has been one of the most wonderful things in my life, and she's always been important. And I think about how many times I've actually changed careers or aspects of my career because the value to raise her in a healthy and happy and a high self-esteem way has caused me to reevaluate my work priority. One of the roles that I gave up several years ago was one that perhaps I loved most. I was a university professor and was teaching graduate school, and so my hours were 4 to 6, 4 to 8, or 8 to 10. They were evenings. And one of the values that I had was to spend quality and quantity time with my daughter. And, of course, for children, when they get in school, that becomes evening time. And I had to give that role up after 6 years, and it was very hard to do. Now, it led to other exciting things, too. But I think about here how if our values are clear and if we live by our values, if we walk our talk, so to speak, it causes us to then also change other aspects about our own life and reprioritize some of those roles.
And, you know, when we were doing adult seminars, which we still do, we start off with this principle that success is goals and all else is commentary. And for years we've taught goal setting at great length. And then we began incorporating in the principle of values, and we find that in order for a person to be happy, their goals and their values have to fit like a hand in a glove. That psychologists today are coming around to the agreement that most stress, most anxiety, most nervousness, most tension is caused by doing one thing and believing that something else is important. That, like, for instance, you felt uncomfortable if your highest value was your daughter, and yet you weren't spending the evening hours with your daughter, it creates an enormous amount of stress. So you find that the most important word, and we call this the C word, is courage, is that in order to be serious about values, you have to have the courage to make the decisions that are consistent with them. And the second part about values is that values are always organized in a hierarchy.
I think that we might want to pick up here on talking about how we teach our children this hierarchy of values. I know for me, if I look at how this applies to my own daughter, when she was younger, I would pick her up from school at a certain time, of course, and that picking her up was so that she wouldn't be standing on the curb without anyone there. And I wanted to be there on time, so I wanted to make sure she was on time. And I think about how that value has paid off over the years. I would say to her, you be there at 3:30. Your mother is going to be there at 3:30, and I made a point of never being late. And if by any chance I was, I apologized and said why I was late and so on. But she knew that she was to be there at 3:30. And now my daughter is in the dating years. And if I say, I want you to be home at 11, or I want you to be home at 11:15, she doesn't test that principle at all. Time has become such an important value, a trust between us, that she's there.
So when we talk about a hierarchy, we have to realize that higher order values always take precedence over lower order values. Now, what does that mean? It means if a person says that my values in life are my family, my health, and my career, let us just say that as an example of three, that means that you will always sacrifice your health to your family, you will always sacrifice your career to your family. If a person says my values in life are, let us say, family, health, career, and integrity, in that order, it means that you would always sacrifice integrity to your success in your career. You'd sacrifice your integrity to your health. You'd sacrifice your integrity to your family. So thinking through your order of values is important. And if one of your goals is to be an excellent parent, if you've made that decision, then your highest material or temporal value has to be your family. You have to say, my family is the value that takes precedence over all other values. Once you've made that decision, what does it mean? It means that when push comes to shove, that value is engraved in stone. If your boss needs you and your family needs you, there's no choice. It's your family. If it's health, if it's money, if it's time, if it's anything, including changing a career, if your family and the people that rely on you take precedence as your primary value, then you quite easily make decisions that you relegate all others to lower orders of importance.
You know, isn't it exciting to watch adults today make more of those decisions around family? I watched 10 years ago where more people would move across the country and disrupt their families many times over without thinking about how will this really affect my children? How will this affect the family cohesiveness in the schools and things? And now I'm seeing adults really say, no, this is not the time for me to move. This is not the best time for me to do this. And I find it a real refreshing time right now.
I have found that, for instance, truth is a terribly important value for your children and your family, if you make the decision that you will always tell the truth, that no matter what the question, no matter what the situation, if your children ask you a question or something comes up, you will always tell the truth. Now, you may say, I don't want to talk about that, or I don't want to answer that. But if you do answer it, you'll tell the truth. So my children, even though they're very young, they'll come to me with questions about sex. They'll come to me with questions about my wife's or my background or childhood or what other people are doing or relationships. They'll come with some very penetrating questions, but they come and they ask the questions very directly, and they always know that they'll get a truthful answer, that even if they're very young, they'll still get a truthful and direct and honest answer. And it's amazing how few of their friends' parents will give them honest answers. As a matter of fact, our children now become a source of information. If their friends want to get the right answer, they give the question to one of our children, and the children ask us directly, what is the answer? And they take it back.
And love and compassion are other values that we show. And we see this as we reach out and love our own children, and we see that they're able to come back and love and show compassion back again to us.
Now, in order to build really strong, self-confident young people, they have to have an internal sense of values that acts as a guide for them. And there's two ways that they get those values. One is they just observe their parents. Parents' values are always expressed in what parents do. Not what parents say, but what they do. In fact, there is a theory that says that you can look on your past behaviors as an indication of what your true values are. It's not what you say or what you hope or wish or espouse or write or teach. It is only what you do in a crisis, only what you do when you have to make a decision, only what you do when sacrifice is involved that tells everybody around you what you truly believe as an operating principle.
Another subtle indicator, Brian, is that it's not just what you say, but also how you say it. How you say and show your value. I think about the values that my father instilled. And my father was a farmer. In Iowa, and I grew up in Iowa, you'd have to go in the middle of the night, go down to the barnyard to check the animals to see that they didn't freeze or get stranded in the middle of the night. And my father, of these six children, chose me to do this. And I remember something about my father during those times. He was most loving, most listening, most understanding, most caring. And he would talk forever. I mean, it was just one stream of talking. But I do know that of those six children, I was the only one who left home, you know, who moved across the country, who traveled extensively, who acquired extensive amounts of schooling and so on. And those values came not so much from what he said, although that was important, but it was how he said it in the middle of those nights when we were making rounds. And I'll never forget that. I think that's a powerful part of how values are instilled, and that is how you say it.
Yes. And of course, children are always observing your behaviors, what you say and what is behind what you say. And if there is incongruence between what you say and what you do, the child will always believe the behavior. A second way to establish values, and that brings us to really the subject of what we've been talking about here, is to discuss the values and agree upon your family philosophy, to agree upon a family mission statement. And I've written out here an idea of a sample family mission statement. What this is sort of like a credo, or this is the terms that the family will live by, and this is the basis for the relationships and the interactions between the members of the family. Let me read it to you. Here's an example, and anybody can create their own. The mission of our family is to create an environment where each person feels free to be happy and to fulfill his or her potential within an environment of love, patience, helpfulness, support, sharing, caring, understanding, and being there for each other.
And you see, from that mission statement then, that would direct the activities. That would say, here's what we value, here's important, and therefore, here are the expectations that we expect from each member of the family.
That's right. And if you say, we are going to create an environment of love, that's one of our values, that's part of our mission statement, then any time that you have a tendency to become irritable or angry or anything, you say, wait a second, is this consistent with how we've agreed to live together? If patience is a value, then you set that up, and anyone in the family can say, are you being patient? Is this an example of patience? Your children then are free to call you on the values. Just as you are entitled to call them and say, wait a minute, we agreed to live like this and interact like this, they're free to call you too and to hold your feet to the fire as well.
And this serves children well in later life. You know, as children get to be teens and older, they'll make decisions if they're going to have a cigarette or try drugs or alcohol. Children will make choices for themselves. The best we can do as parents is to provide a framework from which those choices will allow children to make responsible decisions and responsible choices, really.
One of the most important values to instill is the value of truth or integrity. You know, there are a series of values which are called spiritual values, and we should talk about these because really these are the values that develop character in young people. One of them is truth, teaching young people respect for truth, teaching young people to honor truth, teaching young people to seek truth and to never deviate from what is true. And there's two reasons for that. One, of course, honesty is the best policy, but the other is that a person only feels high self-esteem when they're living in truth with themselves and with other people. So giving a young person a value like truth as an operating principle is an act of great kindness because it can serve them all their lives.
Right, and another one would be just open communications, that how we relate to one another, what we say to one another is caring and kind and considerate, that we're serving as an ear, you know, that we're serving as a listening, that we're there as a support unit for each other.
Yes, another is compassion. One of the great Christian values or spiritual principles is the principle of compassion, which means what? It means being sensitive and caring about people who are less fortunate, rather than dismissing them or blaming them. Being compassionate, when you see someone or you read about an experience where someone has suffered, expressing compassion and actually physically and even financially doing things to help those who are less fortunate sets a very important example for young people to give them a sense of interconnectedness with the universe.
What we're really saying to parents is that they can choose from so many things that are important to them, what their philosophy will be. And I think a real important message is that parents can deliberately change the course of their family life. Many parents are not happy with their family life or wish that it could be better or wish that it could be happier. And children, too, want to be, as we talked earlier about, they want to come from a happy family. They want to come from people who are loving and caring and show that love and support. And what we're really saying is that by choosing a course or a direction, and to have it hinged to some really important values, you can change the quality of the family life.
Yes, and children need consistency. They need routine. They need boundaries. They need to know that there is order in the universe. And what gives order to their universe is a very clearly articulated framework of values that the parents repeat over and over again. We always tell the truth. We are always kind to each other. We always help each other. We always share. In other words, and the parents live it. They say it, and then they live it. They say it, and then they live it. And they demonstrate it so often to their children. Then they reward and encourage their children. When the children discipline themselves and work hard and get a good grade, or when the children carry through with a task and finish it and do it completely, the parents make a big fuss about it. They say, this is what living up to this value means. This is excellent behavior and conduct. At a certain point, the child internalizes. It actually becomes part of the child's cell structure. So when they go out in the world, they're surrounded by temptations to go in a variety of different directions. This set of values acts as their gyroscope. And that's the key to raising happy children. That's the key to building self-esteem. That's the key to creating a wonderful family.
And I think that this really is the crux of our program, too, and that is to say to parents that parenting needn't be so chancy, that we can decide what we want for our family life. And whether your family is a parent and a child or a parent and several children or two adults co-parenting or whether it's a husband and wife, you can change the direction. You can decide what you want for your family. And this is a powerful way to base it on values and to make sure that the family is a home place, is a place where high self-esteem, where hope, where confidence, where self-assuredness, where feeling positive, where feeling like you belong can happen.
And so when the child comes home, the child knows that he or she is secure, that this environment is predictable, and it's predictable on a high level of quality, which are the values. One final thing about values, Betty, that's so important is that you have to be careful about the values you select because values become fixed. Values are not situational. One of the great problems in ethics in America today is the number of people whose values are very flexible depending upon the situation. But values in a family are fixed. They're engraved in stone. You never deviate from the values. The values are locked in, and you as a parent, once you've chosen those values, have also chosen that you will behave consistent with these values no matter the price, no matter the sacrifice, no matter how tired you are, no matter how irritated, no matter how much your children may not cooperate or do their share, you've made the decision that these are the values that you'll build your family on. And as they say, a house built upon a rock cannot be moved by a storm.
Right. And basically that there are some values that are non-negotiable.
Yes. And once children know that there are non-negotiable values, that these are the fixed standards, and that the standards are life-giving, the standards are supportive of feeling good about yourself, feeling that you are a good human being when you live out these values. Once children know that, then they're free to develop to their full potential.
Session 4, Raising Responsible Children. Being a role model is perhaps the most vital job of parenting. In this session, Betty and Brian discuss the framework for making responsible decisions, evaluating the consequences, and accepting responsibility.
We've been talking about a family philosophy and its role in helping us raise happy, healthy, and self-confident children. And in this session, let's focus on raising responsible children.
I think one of the most important values that a family can have is that each individual accepts personal responsibility for various parts of their lives.
Kind of like the 100% responsibility rule.
Well, that's right. One of the things that we know is when children are born, they have zero responsibility. And as they grow up, they go from 0 to 5% to 10% and so on. By the age of 18, one of the primary roles of parenting is to have the child reach the stage where they are prepared to accept 100% responsibility for themselves and for everything they become from that point forward.
And I think research shows that helping children become self-responsible lends itself to feeling more confident, being able to monitor their own actions, so to speak.
Well, yes, and a tremendous part of self-confidence comes from being in control of your own life, what psychologists call an internal locus of control, feeling that you're behind the wheel of your own life. And what we have found is that there's a one-to-one relationship between how much responsibility you accept at each stage and for each part of your life and how much you feel in control. And that sense of control is what causes a child to feel terrific about themselves.
And that's the feedback on our book, in the book that we wrote, the Achievement, Happiness, Popularity, and Success, the self-esteem book for young people. When we get feedback from the schools, that's the chapter that children feel most empowered by. That just the idea that they can take responsibility for themselves is a very empowering feeling.
Well, for most adults, it's a very empowering feeling, because we've been taught from infancy to believe that we are dependent upon other people, that things happen to us, that we do what we're told, that we're sort of caught up as cogs in the great machine of society. When you accept the idea that you are the primary creative force in your own life and that everything that's ever going to happen to you is going to be as a result of what you do, when you say things like, if it's to be, it's up to me. Now, it's very trite. If it's to be, it's up to me. But it's the sort of thing that a young child can anchor on, and they can realize that now that they're an adult, anything that's to be is going to be up to them. And as you say, it is very empowering.
Yeah, you know, a major stake as parents helping children be responsible is not only because children who take responsibility for themselves and some of their actions, not only does it help us raise them, I mean, they're certainly easier to raise, self-monitoring children are easier, but it also lends to these areas of self-esteem we've been talking about, Brian, and that is feeling capable and feeling purposeful.
Yes.
So it begins to develop, so to speak, those internal motivators.
We find that using the repeated admonition, you are responsible, you are responsible, you are responsible, as soon as a child is old enough for that to be a fact, they are responsible for cleaning up their room. They're responsible for their share of the family tasks. If the table is not set, Michael, you are responsible. And repeating this over and over again gradually expands the area of a child's life where he or she perceives that he or she is in control.
Let's talk about some of the things that we do as parents to help children develop responsible behavior, because I think most parents want their children to be responsible, and in fact, it's kind of a sore area between them. You know, they say, oh, you're so irresponsible, or take more responsibility. Let's talk about how we develop that. I know when I think about teaching my daughter to be responsible, I think about three areas. The first is I try to teach her that she can count on me. You know, if I say I'm going to be there at a certain time, or if I've made a promise, I keep it. One of the first things for me is to show her that I can be accountable.
That you are responsible.
Right.
Children learn to be responsible two ways. One is, of course, that they learn by modeling. Do their parents accept responsibility, or are their parents always blaming someone else? And the second, the way they learn, is by being given responsibilities and then being made to fulfill those responsibilities. We'll talk about high achievers in a later session, but we know that parents who raised low-achieving children were found to give their children responsibilities, but then they took them back, or the children delegated them back when it was no longer convenient. So therefore, giving the responsibility and then holding the child's feet to the fire, insisting, no, this is now your responsibility, and encouraging the child, rewarding the child, insisting that the child do it, is the starting point of building a fully functioning adult.
Yeah, the holding the child accountable and then teaching the consequences of being accountable, so to speak.
Yes. In the work that's been done in peak performance, both in young people and adults, we find the two foundation qualities of peak performance are self-esteem and self-responsibility. A child with self-esteem is willing and eager to accept responsibility. A fully responsible child has a heightened sense of self-esteem, so the two mutually reinforce each other.
I think the other thing that I do that I believe has high payoffs, because I've seen it come back over and over with my own daughter, is that I teach her that others can count on me, that not only am I accountable, but others can count on me. And I'm reminded of a young girl that she had staying overnight, and the young girl wanted to stay home from school the next day. And I said, well, you can't stay home from school today. No one's going to be here. Plus, what would your mother and father say about this? And she said, well, we have one day a semester that we can jip without having to account for it, and I'm going to take that day today. And she followed through with that. And I see this sometimes in the workforce, where a company may have a policy where you might be allowed a certain number of sick days. And you'll see some people invariably take every one of those days because they feel that it's there for them. And what that means really is that they aren't taking full responsibility. And I think that's an important message we send to children is I can be counted on and others can count on me. It's not just that I have a sick day coming, but in fact, others in the workforce, the team, is counting on me and I need to be there. Children learn this through sports, hopefully, that they need to be there to be on the team.
You know, there is a thing called the universal maxim, which was propounded by philosopher Immanuel Kant. And what he said was to live your life as though your every act were to become universal law. And a way of paraphrasing that is to ask yourself the question and teach your children to ask variations of it. What kind of a family would my family be if everybody in it were just like me? Or what kind of a team would my team be if everybody on it were just like me? And what you do is you ask children to hold themselves accountable to a higher standard, a standard that clicks in even when there's nobody there to watch them.
Right, and so keeping commitments and keeping promises becomes a real important part in teaching children responsible behavior.
That's right. Again, they learn it from their parents. The opposite of accepting responsibility is blaming and making excuses and criticizing. And there is a joke that says that insanity is hereditary. You catch it from your children. But I would say irresponsibility is also hereditary, that you learn it from your parents. Children learn to be irresponsible by being blamed by their parents, by being continually criticized, by being shouted at. So whenever something goes wrong in their household, the parent looks around to blame somebody. This is the essence of irresponsible behavior. It's also the essence of neurotic behavior, and it leads to low performance, low self-esteem, and tremendous feelings of guilt and unworthiness on the part of the child.
You know, I know we really see this in the schools where teachers complain over and over that children won't take responsibility. They believe that you, the teacher, gave them the low grade, or that you, you know, allowed something else to happen to them. You made me turn off the television, so and so on, as opposed to taking that responsibility. And we see it as a primary cause of low motivation, when in fact it really is a symptom of just not accepting full responsibility.
Yes, and I've done some work in the prison systems, and I've spoken to many prisoners, and I've also spoken to people who work as psychological counselors with prisoners. And what they have found over and over again, that the critical factor in whether or not a person goes to jail and gets out and goes back again is whether or not they accept responsibility for having gotten themselves there in the first place. If a prisoner says, I am responsible, I did the things that got me here, nobody is to blame but me, they can be very secure in predicting that that prisoner will not be back. But if the prisoner continually makes excuses and say, I didn't do it, and it's not my fault, and I'm not really guilty, and I just got a lousy deal, then you can be sure that within 6 months that person will be back in prison.
When I work with parents around the nation, one of the things parents come back to me with is, well, I'm trying to make my child learn to be responsible, but when he gets in a jam, he won't be. And I think a primary skill that is very helpful for parents is to teach children how to solve problems, because then if they have some kind of a framework to generate alternatives and solve problems, they're more likely to commit to it. And I kind of use a four-step model, and I say to parents, help children ask the question, what is the problem here? Secondly, what can I do to solve it? In other words, what alternatives can I generate? And the third is, what is my plan? And the fourth is, how did I do? You know, the evaluation process. But when children have some sense that they can get themselves out of problems and out of dilemmas, they're more likely to commit to specific behaviors to be responsible and therefore follow through.
There's an ABC model of human behavior that makes it very simple to understand why people do things. And A stands for antecedents, or what takes place or is said before. B stands for behavior. And C stands for the consequences of the behavior, or what happens as a result of what you do. And what psychologists have found is that 85% of behavior is determined by the consequences that the child expects as a result of doing what they do. Only 15% of the behavior is motivated by what somebody says or what they are told, but 85% is based on the expectations that the child has of the consequences that will ensue. So if a child is made to clearly believe that certain positive consequences will follow from a particular act, that is 85% of the child's motivation to perform the act.
That's part of the work of parenting, too, and that is following through. If you say that something is the consequence, if you do this, you will have this. If you don't do this, this is the response, then you have to follow through, because children pick up that cue. They know if you're going to follow through or not.
Yes. In my family, we have a little thing that I call a daddy promise. Now, my children are young, but at a certain age, I would say, now, this is a daddy promise. Now, what does that mean? It means that they know that I will go through with it. They know that there is a 100% chance that if I characterize something that I say I'll do as a daddy promise, then they had better fulfill their side of it, because there's no getting out of it. What has happened now is, even though my children are still young, 3, 7, and 9, they are now coming back to me, and they are giving me a Christina promise, or a Michael promise, or even a little 3-year-old David promise. And they recognize that when they give a promise with their name on it, they're saying to me in the utmost seriousness, this is something, Daddy, that I will do, because my name is on it, and they have been taught that by me. And it's very satisfying.
Yeah, it's something that they have learned as a result of your behavior. And that's an important part of helping children learn to be responsible. You know, right along that same vein, earlier I talked about that when Jennifer was little, time was real important, not only because I was cutting it close, picking her up from school and being in my university teaching role, but it was also a safety measure. It was a way for me to feel safe about her not getting into trouble after school or being picked up, you know, by a stranger, all those fears that parents go through. And now, many years later, I see this coming back to play in her responsible behavior. If she says she's going to be somewhere at a certain time, I can count on it. She rarely goes back on that word. You know, earlier I said she's now dating. I see this if I say, I would like to have you in at a certain time. She's there. She doesn't even contest it.
And this is something that can only be taught at the knee of the parent. There is no school that can teach it. There's no relative. There is no sibling. There is no peer that can possibly teach a child this. In reality, what we're really talking about here is self-discipline. We're talking about the ability of a child to master themselves, to do what they should do in the short term, to enjoy the gains in the long term. And a definition of self-discipline that I really like comes from Thomas Huxley, where he said, and I paraphrase it slightly, he said, to do what you should do when you should do it, whether you feel like it or not. To do what you should do when you should do it, whether you feel like it or not. And in that last line, whether you feel like it or not, is the entire key to raising responsible children. You see, it's very easy for a child or an adult to do something if they feel like it. It's when you don't feel like it, but you recognize that it's the right thing to do, and you force yourself to do it even though you'd rather not, even though you're tired, even though you're distracted or you have something else to do. That is the true mark of character, and that's where the parent can bring their influence to bear, is to get the child through the points where they don't feel like doing it, but they do it anyway, and have them emerge on the other side with their character developed at a higher level.
Well, there's no doubt about that having a child commit to something lends itself to raising self-esteemed children. And there is a model that parents can use to bring that about. And it's just a series of three events, really. And the first is to state what's going on for your child. Sometimes a parent will say, "This room looks like a pit." What you're saying is, "Please clean up this room." And what we ask parents to do is to get very specific. Say exactly what's going on. Say, "There are clothes all over your room." And the second part of that is to follow through and give the child very specific directions on what you want done. Rather than to say, "Clean this place up," a parent should say, "I'd like to have you pick up all of these clothes and hang them up in the closet."
You know what I do with my children is I say, "I'm going to come and inspect your bedroom, and I want a mouse to be able to walk across your entire bedroom floor without tripping over anything. Is that clear?"
Does that work for you?
Yes, it does. And if there's one thing, then I'm going to get you. And I make a joke out of it, but my children have an absolutely clear picture. And you would be astonished how clean their floor is. And if they pick it up, they put it in a laundry or a drawer or a cupboard. But when I say I want it so clean a mouse can go across it, they know exactly what that means. They run to their bedroom and they do it exactly that way, time after time after time.
Well, you're really following through on the third part of this, and that is to provide some positive feedback. What we really mean here is that we say to a child, "Here are the consequences." And if you can state them in a positive up front, a child is more likely to be committed to following through rather than saying, "If you don't," you know, because that's not going to win the child's heart or cooperation. Say, "And when you do this, you know, you will enjoy your room more and I will be so proud of you," and you can say whatever else you want. But what you're doing is you're setting a positive outcome. And really what you're doing in that example, Brian, is just setting a positive response and they're working toward that. But the point here is that children are more likely to follow through if there's a positive response at the end. And sometimes as parents, we get annoyed and leave the child with a very negative outcome, and they're not going to follow through.
Again, it's coming back to the consequences. If they can anticipate positive consequences, like anything sweet or positive, what I do for positive consequences for my children, and my children are not angels, is I give them a lot of positive reinforcement. I hug them, and I kiss them, and I praise them, and I pat them on the head. One of the things which I do, and I watch them beam, is I say, "This is clean, but you couldn't possibly have done this by yourself. Somebody had to have helped you. Now, who helped you do this?" If they get a good grade, I say, "Come on, who helped you?" Or if they clean up something, and they say, "No, I did it all by myself." And I say, "You did it all by yourself?" They say, "Yes." I say, "That's amazing. That's amazing." And I use this as an opportunity to make a big thing of it. But I can assure you of this, that I get lots and lots of that behavior that I make a big thing of.
And I can assure you this works when children are little. But when they get to be teens, they're looking for awards and rewards. And again, though, it's the positive reinforcement that's more likely to get your child to commit to the responsible behavior. And you know, in the last session, we were talking about values in a philosophy. And one of the things that we said was that children who are healthy and happy and have a high sense of self-esteem are more likely to commit to specific things based upon a core of values.
Yes.
The point here is that we want children to be responsible, and they're more likely to do that if they have a core of values. Children are going to decide to make choices whenever they want. They're more likely to follow through and commit to being responsible if they know what that framework of values really is.
Yeah, and one of the things we find about a positive set of core values is that children feel good about themselves whenever they act consistent with the values. Now, there's some values that are simply family-based or culturally oriented or are particular to the parent, which may or may not have any widespread validity. For instance, whether you sit up straight at the table may or may not be a value that causes a child to feel good about themselves. But if you express compassion to other people, if you tell the truth, if you finish your commitments or fulfill your jobs when you promise that you will, these are things that are inherently reinforcing.
Well, the no blaming, the no excuses, the no ignoring, the no denying are behaviors, Brian, that effective parents do to bring about this responsibility.
Let's talk about some of the barriers to responsibility. And one of the models that you just touched on is important. And it's the five-level step in dealing with a child who is acting irresponsibly. Let us say a child has problems with their homework. They're not doing their homework or they're getting poor grades at school. We find there's five levels that you have to go through in order to get the child to deal with it. And the first step is when you bring it to the child's attention, always the child and even adults will ignore the problem. They will pretend that the problem is not happening at all. They'll pretend that they're not getting low grades or that their bedroom is not messy or that they weren't really very late coming home. When you bring it to the child's attention, the second step is the child will deny. They'll say, well, it's not true, or it's not important, or everybody else is doing it, or it's not my fault. The third step is that they'll blame someone else. They'll say, I didn't do it, somebody else did. He did it, she did it, they did it. It was the rain, the sun, the moon, and so on. You have to go through each of these steps, ignore, deny, blame. The next step is to accept responsibility. And once you've gotten to that step, the child will say, yes, I'm responsible. And you say, you are responsible. No matter what they say, you are responsible, like holding them to the wall with a thumbtack. And only when the child has said, yes, I'm responsible, can you go on to take action.
There's a very important principle here that I think we want our parents to look at and examine, and that is that children simply test the boundaries of our love. They want to know, where is the framework for a yes and a no? And you and I do that too in relationships. I mean, we want to know what is acceptable and what isn't. Fidelity is an example. In a relationship, a married relationship, you want to know, is fidelity a value here or not? And once you understand it, you feel comfortable. You move on to develop other aspects of the relationship. Children always test the boundary. I like your idea of the cattle idea.
Yes, I used to live on a cattle ranch. I was telling you about that the other day. And it was called a feeding station out in Barstow in Southern California. And what they did is they would bring in cattle by train and truck, and then they would fatten them up and then ship them into Los Angeles. And they'd bring the cattle and they'd offload them into a new pasture. And the very first thing the cattle would do after they were offloaded from the truck or the train is they would begin a walk. And the lead cow or the lead steer would start off and begin walking the whole outside of the fence, the entire boundary of the fence. Before they started to graze, before they did anything else, they all got in a long line. And if you ever go to a cow pasture, you'll find that there is a cow path, a worn path that goes all the way around just inside the pasture, because every new cow that comes into the pasture walks the whole fence line to find out what their boundaries are before they then settle down and start to graze.
Well, it's a powerful guideline and analogy, really, for parents in looking at the role of discipline in helping children be responsible. Because too often we do, as I say, zap bad behavior. We wait for a child to do something bad and then we zap him on it. You know, we correct him. As opposed to setting out the framework of clear and reasonable guidelines in place first.
And what we also found is that if there was one hole in the fence, one gate left open in a pasture that may be several hundred acres, the cows would invariably find it and they would go out of the pasture through that hole.
Right, and likewise, a child will test the one value that you haven't made clear, and he will test the boundaries so he knows what is allowable here and what's not. And by the way, they want to know, are you going to be consistent on following up the consequences? Are they consistent or not?
Yes, and even though children express disapproval and anger and frustration, secretly it's been shown over and over again that they feel secure inside. They feel safe when they know that the values or the boundaries are fixed. And that's why they found that laissez-faire parenting, permissive parenting, has not raised children that are more creative and that are more spontaneous. It's raised children that are more neurotic, that have more fragmented personalities, that are more insecure and unstable than children that are raised with very firm and fair boundaries.
That's right. And they have found that even children who are gifted cannot go through with their creativity to fully express themselves until they too know the boundaries. And that once children know the boundaries, they then feel so safe to operate within those boundaries. And I think that children also equate the guidelines with how much we love them. I have very specific guidelines for my daughter, and I'm thinking back to the time when a little girl by the name of Linda came to stay with us about a month ago, and she stayed on Friday evening. And Saturday evening was approaching, and I said, do you need to call your mother here and have her come pick you up? And she said, oh, my mother won't be back in town until Tuesday. And I was taken back, and I said, where are you staying tonight? And she said, can I stay with you? And I said, yes, but does your mother know? And she said, my mother won't be checking in with me until Tuesday. And I was surprised. And I said to my daughter after that, I said, Linda doesn't have to check in with her mother until Tuesday? And she said, no. And I said, why do you think Linda chose to stay with us? Because I'd been noticing a trend of Linda staying quite often, and they were extended days. And she said, because her mother likes her staying with you because you're so strict. And I said, I'm so strict? And she said, yes, you have guidelines. And so children sense our caring. And it was interesting that this little girl, Linda, had come back to Jennifer and said, your mother really loves you. I'm not sure my mother loves me. And she was again referring to the guidelines that kept her in. So our guidelines are a boundary to our children that says to them, you are valued. Let me show you. Here are the boundaries that are safe for you. And outside of those boundaries, then I step in.
You were saying a little bit earlier that female children, the most important person in their life up to the age of about 16 or 17 is their father. And in a study that was done on the mental health of female children a few years ago, they found that the critical factor in personality development was the father, but not just the father, but how concerned the father was about the child's development. They said the father could be a tyrant, he could be inordinately strict, he could be easygoing or laid back, he could be an extrovert, he could be an introvert, he could spend a lot of time with the child or a little time, but the primary single factor that determined healthy personality development was that the female child always knew that the parent really cared and was concerned about what they did and what happened to them.
There's a very beautiful saying called Children Learn What They Live. Perhaps you've seen it on a plaque or posters. It's often around in parenting stores, and it goes like this. It says, if a child lives with criticism, he learns to condemn. If a child lives with hostility, he learns to fight. If a child lives with ridicule, he learns to be shy. If a child lives with shame, he learns to feel guilty. And if a child lives with tolerance, he learns to be patient. If a child lives with praise, he learns to appreciate. And if he lives with fairness, he learns justice. And if he lives with security, he learns to have faith. If a child lives with approval, he learns to like himself. And if a child lives with acceptance and friendship, he learns to find love in the world.
You know, I think before we finish this session, something that we've taught hundreds of thousands of parents is that destructive criticism is the greatest single obstacle to a child accepting responsibility for himself or herself and for their life. And the destructive criticism that parents unknowingly or unwittingly give in an attempt to guide and shape their children's behavior actually lowers self-esteem, lowers self-image, and creates great feelings of guilt and unworthiness in the child. And one of the pieces of advice that we give to parents is this, is that if you've made mistakes in the past in your attempts to raise responsible children, if you have used destructive criticism, if you've done or said anything that has made your child feel inferior or unworthy or guilty or less valuable, then sit the child down and go through this exercise. The first part of the exercise is to apologize to your children, to say to your children that I'm sorry for anything that I've ever done or said that has hurt you, because I would never want to do anything that would cause you to be unhappy about yourself or not to grow up and feel good about yourself. Second, promise never to do it again. Say, from now on, we're going to abolish destructive criticism from our family. We're not going to use it in this family. Many parents have a terrible time with this idea because they think that to admit that they were wrong and to apologize to their children is a mark of weakness. But in reality, it's a mark of strength. Not only is it a mark of strength, but it gives your children the strength to be able to apologize for the mistakes they make. And the final part of this is to practice forgiveness with your children on an ongoing basis. If you forget, if you say something critical, if you are harsh, if you're impatient, go to the child and say, I'm sorry, I apologize. The whole purpose of this is for you to accept 100% responsibility for everything and anything that you do or say that could lower the child's self-esteem or could cause the child to feel destructively criticized. If you will say, I'm sorry, will you forgive me? And I started practicing this when my children were 1 and 2 years old, when they could just learn to speak. I'd always say, I'm sorry, will you forgive me? Or I apologize, I shouldn't have shouted at you. Even if the child has been misbehaving, I still say, what's important here? What's important here is my child's self-esteem. So I'll go to them and I'll say, I'm sorry I shouted at you. I shouldn't have said it that loudly. Even if the child was, if you like, guilty, I'll always apologize. And now my children will come to me and they'll say, Daddy, I forgive you too. And sometimes I'll send a child to their bedroom and they'll come out and they'll say, I forgive you. And it's gotten to the point where we allow absolutely no negativity, no blame, no criticism to build up. We always apologize. We always say we're sorry. We always forgive and we always take it back. And it's the foundation of raising high-performing young people.